The Emperor Has No Clothes Award is based on a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale about the young boy, or maybe young girl, we could call it a young girl, who just said the way it was. The Emperor has no clothes. The Emperor doesn't have anything on. And everyone else was pretending. Everyone else was into the illusion. And one person, I think we have a room full of people like that today, don't we? Who are not afraid to just tell it like it is. So our award, the Emperor Has No Clothes Award, is a statuette, a nice statuette. It's made by the same people who make the Oscar. It's a gold-plated statue of the naked emperor with a scepter and a mirror. And we've given it to a number of people. George Carlin, Penn and Teller. You might have seen a show where Penn and Teller's apartment was remodeled, and when they finished it, there was their Emperor Award on the. You know, they're very proud of that. Today we are going to give the Emperor Has No Clothes Award to writer and journalist Dan Savage. Oh, here's the award. Can you see it? It's a little heavy. So if you want one of these, first become famous, and then tell it like it is. We were really impressed with a review in the New York Times that ran last April. Dan Savage wrote a review of a book by Jeff Chu, called Does Jesus Really Love Me? And part of that review, Dan Savage wrote, Jeff Chu worries that gay people like Mr. Byers have been pushed out of the church. That's not true for all of us. My father was a Catholic deacon, my mother was a lay minister, and I thought about becoming a priest. I was in church every Sunday for the first 15 years of my life. Now I spend my Sundays on my bike, on my snowboard, or on my husband. I haven't spent my post-Catholic decades in a sulk, wishing the church would come around on the issue of homosexuality so that I could start attending Mass again. I didn't abandon my faith. I saw through it. The conflict between my faith and my sexuality set that process in motion, but the conclusions I reached at the end of that process, there are no gods, religion is man-made, faith can be a force for good or evil, they improved my life. I'm grateful that my sexuality prompted me to think critically about faith. Pushed out? No, I walked out. For that comment, and many others like it, in his columns and in his new book, American Savage, which he will be signing at the evening's conclusion. And also, you might have heard him on Free Thought Radio a few weeks ago talking about that book. Dan Savage clearly has earned FFRF's Emperor Has No Clothes Award. Dan Savage is best known for his long-published, internationally syndicated sex column called Savage Love. He's a media pundit, a journalist, a newspaper editor. He writes the internationally syndicated relationship and sex advice column. Savage graduated from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and he is married to Terry Miller. And by the way, tomorrow we'll have another distinguished son of Champaign, Illinois, speaking with us. Dan has one son, DJ Savage, and Miller. They are the founders of the It Gets Better project, which I think a project that is literally saving lives. It's an initiative to prevent gay teen suicide. The foundation is saluting Dan for making known his dissent from religion, but also want to salute this life-affirming project, giving hope and comfort to LGBTQ teenagers, many of whom are suffering in part because or suffering more because of the idea, as Dan Savage has written in one of his columns, that loving Jesus means hating gay people, as proclaimed in Christian churches and on Christian TV and radio broadcasts. He currently stars in Savage U on MTV. He contributes to This American Life and Out magazine and acts as a real-time real reporter on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. I've read his book, American Savage, Insights, Slights, and Fights on Faith, Sex, Love, and Politics. So let's welcome Dan Savage. Where are you? And here's your Emperor Has No Clothes. You can get a photo with that. Set it there, or you want.
Hello. In the 1980s, the early 1980s, the Catholic Television Network in Chicago, which was a Catholic cable channel, did a special on my family because we were the perfect Catholic family. My dad was an ordained Catholic deacon. My mom was a Catholic lay minister. They ran Catholic marriage encounter sessions in Illinois and Wisconsin and Indiana. And I was in the seminary. I was going to be a priest. All four of their children had been confirmed in the church. Catholic confirmation is like Catholic bar mitzvah. It's when you become an adult. They baptize you as an infant. And then when you're 13 years old and under no duress and no pressure from your family to remain Catholic, you're asked to affirm your confirmation, or affirm your baptism, and that is your confirmation as a Catholic. And all four of their kids have been confirmed in the church, and they did this special on my family. And my dad was also a Chicago homicide detective. So it was sort of a gun in the pulpit, perfect Catholic family special. And 2 years later, sitting around the kitchen table with my mom and my siblings, we sat there joking and laughing, at the idea of the Chicago Catholic Television Network returning to our home and doing a Where Are They Now special. Because my father had left my mother, divorced my mother, and been defrocked. I had come out of the closet. My brother Billy, my oldest sibling, had gotten a preemptive vasectomy. And my other two siblings had, between them, fathered a couple of abortions. And my mother was sleeping with a married man. And it wasn't the man that she had been married to. And this struck us as pretty hilarious, the Where Are They Now special. And by that time, when I was 17 or 18 years old, I was a hardcore agnostic. Because I had questions. And as in the selection from that New York Times review that you read, it was really my faith, my sexuality that brought me into conflict with my faith. But I had always had questions. I was inquisitive, and ironically, it was my parents that sort of encouraged their kids to be, to question authority, to question things, to not take the received wisdom for an answer. And from a very early age, I had been asking the inappropriate or awkward questions of the nuns, of the priests, and of my parents, my dad, who was, for all intents and purposes, a Catholic priest. I remember one day when I was 7 or 8 or 9 years old, looking at an illustrated children's encyclopedia and finding this big drawing of an Aztec procession up a pyramid to carve the heart out of someone or other. And I was looking at this procession and the Aztec priests in their big flowing robes and people carrying ceremonial objects in front of them and being trailed by sort of secondary priests. And I went to my dad and I said, "That looks like Mass." And I'm sure they believed as passionately as I have been taught to believe in the crap that they believed. And is belief enough of a justification? Is belief, as I have been taught, as you have taught me, is belief some kind of proof? That was not a welcome question in my house. That selection from my New York Times review of Jeff Chu's book, in some ways, I'm so grateful for being gay, despite the chaos that caused when I was 15, 16, 17 years old in my life, because If I hadn't been gay, I sometimes wondered if I would have questioned my sexuality. I would have questioned my faith in relationship to my sexuality. I describe that as the thread I began to pull that unraveled the garment of faith and irrational belief. Not all gay people do that. Some gay people, just when they realize that their faith is in conflict with their sexuality, move on to some new faith that isn't in quite as much conflict. But for me, it kind of fell apart, because I figured that what I had been told by this church was wrong about me, what else is this church wrong about? And that led me to think about all the ways in which we can't know what we can't know, and that we shouldn't trust people who pretend to know the unknowable, that we should acknowledge the unknowable, embrace ambiguity, and think for ourselves, and not think the way our parents taught us necessarily to think, or their parents taught them to think, at which stage going back you found the originator of whatever that faith system or belief system is. My parents had 4 kids, my very Catholic parents, and still Catholic, my dad, and Catholic till the day she died, my mother. And sometimes they would wonder how they wound up with 2 atheists and an agnostic, and 2 agnostic kids. And we didn't know what to tell them, except it's your fault, because you encouraged us to think critically, and eventually we turned that critical thinking skill that you instilled in us to this uncritical, unthinking shit you were shoving down our throats. And it fell apart. I always think of this Christopher Durang play. I'm sure you're all familiar with Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You, especially if you're Catholic. It's a great show. But he wrote a companion piece. Sister Mary is a one act. There's a companion piece that goes with Sister Mary called The Actor's Nightmare. And there's this moment in The Actor's Nightmare where this actor who hasn't been to rehearsal and doesn't know his lines is abandoned on stage and just starts vamping. And this is, I saw it when I was very young with my mother. And there was this moment when he began to say, because he didn't know what else to say, the act of contrition. Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been so many years since my last confession. And then he paused and went, that's the act of contrition. That's what Catholic children say before confession. And then he paused again and went, I imagine Catholic adults would say that before confession, but I have never met a Catholic adult. I have. They are my parents. I call myself an agnostic or an atheist, but sometimes I have to admit to being an agnostotheist, because I do cross myself on airplanes. And I flew here today and crossed myself. I have that superstitious hangover. And I'm sort of an agnostic atheist ingrate, because I cross myself and the plane takes off, but when it safely lands, I just walk off the plane. There's no higher power when you're on the ground. I don't know what else to say, except thank you very much. This is very meaningful to me. A few years ago, I went to the auction. Remember Ann Landers? I'm sure all of you do. I was talking to somebody in their 20s two days ago, and I mentioned Ann Landers, and she said, who? And I had to kill her. So I don't like it when people in their 20s make me feel as old as I am. But 10 years ago, I went to the auction of Ann Landers effects. After her daughter had packed up her big condo on Lakeshore Drive, there was this auction, and I read about it in the paper, and they were going to auction off Ann Landers' desk, the desk at which Ann Landers had for 40 years written her advice column. And I thought, I want to have that desk. And I'd just gotten a book deal that paid stupid money, and I called Margot Howard, who's Ann Landers' daughter. We had been on the radio together after Ann Landers' death. A radio producer had us on a show together to pit us against each other. They thought Margot would talk about how great her mother was and how great her column was and how important and meaningful it was. And me, being the author of the rudest and dirtiest sex advice column in the world, would shit all over Ann Landers and say that she sucked. I can be an asshole, but I am not going to go on a radio program with someone's grieving daughter and talk about how horrible her mother was. Also complicating the producer's hopes was I loved Ann Landers. And I loved her column. And I didn't always agree with her, but who always agrees with anybody? I don't always agree with myself. Sometimes I read columns I wrote 10 years ago and I'm like, what was I smoking? Or thinking? Or smoking then thinking? So we were on the radio with Margot for a while, and I was having a love fest with her about her mom and the contribution she made to the culture. And so I got her phone number, and we chatted on the phone afterwards. So when I was going to go to this auction, I really wanted to have Margot's permission, because I knew it would get written about as somehow disrespectful. I was buying Ann Landers' desk so I could write my dirty column on it and flip her off, which wasn't true. But Margot gave me permission to go to the auction of Ann Landers' effects. And I took, and I'm really embarrassed to say this, I took $10,000 in cash so that I couldn't spend more than that on Ann Landers' desk. This is really stupid, right? What was I smoking? I can tell you. Because I took that much money because I thought I would be bidding against the Smithsonian for Ann Landers' desk. I thought the Smithsonian would be there to buy this desk at which so much had been written about the culture and sexual mores and family and relationships over these decades. And so I took all this money thinking, oh, it's going to be me versus Smithsonian because they're going to want to put it next to Archie Bunker's chair, but I'm going to get it and take it home. I bought Ann Landers' desk for $197. I know, right? No Smithsonian. And then I sat there as they began to auction off all of Ann Landers' awards from the American Cancer Society, from the Leukemia Foundation, from General Motors, the State of Illinois' Illinoisian of the Year, the Chicagoan of the Year Award, a medallion, plaque, tchotchke thing that had been given to her by the Pope when he visited Chicago in the 1960s. Which now sits on my mantle. There is something in my house that a pope has touched, and it's not a 10-year-old boy. I knew that would go over well in this room. So I started buying all of her awards and her trophies and her plaques and her honorary degrees because I figured I write a really dirty sex advice column. I use profanity. When people ask me during my college speaking gigs, as often I get a card, one question, especially when I speak in the South, do you believe in God? And it's a game for me just to read that question and say, nope, and go right on to the next question, as if that doesn't need to be unpacked. It's actually the people who do believe in God who have some explaining to do. Not those of us who do not. So I bought up all these awards and took them home because back then I figured no one's ever going to give me an award. And so the only way I'd ever get an award for writing an advice column is if I bought Ann Landers awards for writing an advice column. And I'm thrilled to say now that I will be able to put this award for me on the mantle next to the award from the Pope that Ann Landers got. And if you follow me on Instagram, which I'm just Dan Savage on Instagram, I will take a picture of this award sitting next to the award from the Pope on my mantle when I get home in a week and a half because I'm going off to some colleges to speak. So I want to thank you all very much for this. It's really very meaningful to me. I can't express it enough. And I was told to not run my mouth too long because they wanted some time for Q&A, and Q&A is my preferred format in everything. So I'm happy to answer any questions if anyone has any questions for the man who has Ann Landers' desk and award from the American Lung Association. Would I take $500 to the desk? No, I have to write my column at it for 4 more decades, so there's 100 years or 80 years of sex columning and advice columning that's happened at this desk, and then maybe the Smithsonian will want it then. Yes? How much cash did I have left after the auction? About $9,200. So I took my mother to lunch because she had come to the auction with me. Yes? And that felt stupid, like carrying that much money around, and I felt like very first world and starving orphans at that moment. But what can you do? You give a gay dude a lot of money and he's going to spend it on stupid stuff. Like this jacket. How I started the It Gets Better project? It's a downer. A 15-year-old kid in Greensburg, Indiana named Billy Lucas killed himself. He'd been very brutally bullied in his middle school and his high school because he was perceived to be gay. He'd never come out to anyone as gay, so he may not even have been gay. Not all victims of anti-LGBT violence or bullying are gay. They're just perceived to be gay. He likely was gay. Gaydar is strong with the middle schoolers and the high schoolers. When I was 15 years old and being bullied for being gay, I was gay. But I was not yet out. And reading about his suicide, and a lot of the things that had been said to him by good Christian kids, right? Because he was sick and sinful. They said God hated him. They said he was going to hell and he might as well get it over with. And I wrote about him from a place of real rage and anger, and then wrote about him again after his family had created a Facebook memorial page. And I get really weepy even when I try to talk about this. Created a Facebook memorial page for him. And the same kids who had been bullying him in high school went to the Facebook memorial page to celebrate his death, to call him a faggot again, to say they were glad he was dead in front of his grieving parents. And I wrote about that from a place of just white hot rage. And I was reading the comments, which were all on this blog post I'd written, which were all similarly outraged and angry and furious. And this commenter, a woman whose handle is Despicable Me, cut through everyone's anger and just wrote, "I wish I had known you, Billy, and been able to tell you that things get better. Rest in peace." And that things get better really kind of gutted me, and that desire to speak to him, you know, I wished I'd known you and been able to talk to you, because things do get better, and they have gotten better at a macro level for the LGBT people broadly, and at a micro level personally for so many of us in our lives after escaping high school. You know, when I came out to my parents in the early 1980s, I was not just telling my mom and my dad, not just burdening them with mental images that took them years to, like, stop seeing. They could look at my sister's boyfriend without seeing his dick in her mouth, but they couldn't look at mine. They couldn't make the same leap with my boyfriend for a while. But telling my parents that I was gay in, you know, the early 1980s meant telling them my very family-oriented, very traditional, until they divorced, mom and dad, that I would never marry, I would never have kids, I would have a marginal career if I had any career at all, and I could never be a Marine. And here we are just in the course of my adult life since age 18, and I am married to the same guy for 20 years. We have a 15-year-old son that we raised from birth together. Now I can be a Marine. I don't want to be a Marine. Much to the relief of the United States Marine Corps. But the kind of gay people who could be Marines and would like to be Marines and would be good Marines can now be Marines and serve openly. They'd always been Marines, gay people. They just couldn't serve openly. And so, you know, I was just traveling around the country, speaking at colleges, thinking, God, I should go to a high school and talk because I need to, like, talk to the next Billy Lucas before he harms himself. But I would never get permission to speak in a high school. I would never particularly get, you know, never get an invitation to speak in high school, but I would never get permission to speak to the kid, the queer kid, who most desperately needs to hear from LGBT adults, which is a kid who has bullying parents. Kids who are queer are at 4 times greater risk of suicide. When their families are hostile, merely hostile, not baroquely hostile, not beating them up, just unaccepting and hostile, that kid is at 8 times greater risk of suicide. That is why I say that Tony Perkins sits on a pile of dead gay children every day when he goes to work. Because he encourages parents to do what he damn well knows doubles the already quadrupled risk of suicide for their queer kids. And then he points to the suicide rate that he is helping to drive and drive up as proof that the gay lifestyle is unhealthy and dangerous. I would never get permission from that parent who is following Tony Perkins' lead to speak to their kid, to tell them that things get better. And it occurred to me on the train to JFK that I was waiting in the YouTube, Facebook, Twitter era for permission I no longer needed to speak to queer kids. That I could record a video, use my column and my podcast to encourage other adults to make videos, upload them to YouTube, encourage LGBT kids to go to YouTube and watch these videos, and bring the LGBT youth support group to that kid whose parents would never allow them to attend one. And it worked. The letter that sticks with me, that I think about all the time, is from a 15-year-old lesbian kid growing up in Texas. I usually don't say the name of the state, so don't remember that. Growing up in a shitty state with a shitty governor. See, if I just said that, that could be Wisconsin. Which is a wonderful state with a shitty governor. Who came out to her parents because she needed their support. She was being bullied because she was perceived to be a lesbian, which she is. And she went to her parents and came out to them, and they did what Tony Perkins tells parents to do. They threatened to disown her, throw her out of the house, cut her off from all contact with her siblings, not pay for her education. If she didn't go into counseling at her megachurch and take it back and not be a lesbian and choose not to be a lesbian. And so she did what so many queer kids before her have done. She lied to her parents under duress and told them that she was mistaken, that she was not a lesbian, that she was confused, because she had to. And so she goes home from her counseling sessions and puts up a poster of Justin Bieber on her wall because that's as close to lesbianism as she can get for a while. And I'm not making fun of effeminate boys with that crack. Anyone who's ever met anybody I've ever dated knows that effeminate boys are my favorites. And she tells her parents she's straight. And she wrote me at Savage Love to tell me that she was watching It Gets Better videos on her phone, in her bed, in her bedroom, under the covers, in her parents' house, in the middle of the night. And that was what we wanted to do. We kicked down her parents' front door, and we marched into their daughter's bedroom, and we climbed into bed with her, and we brought the queer youth support group to her that her parents would not allow her to attend. And and she said that it was helping. She was seeing adult lesbians, also gay people and bi people and trans people whose families had the same reaction that hers is having when they tried to come out, and whose families have come around, whose families now love and accept them. She was seeing lesbians with families of their own and wives and children and colleagues that respected them and friends that loved them for who they really were, and it was giving her hope for that future that was possible for her, and it was getting her through this time when she's being abused and pushed towards suicide by her parents. And when I first launched the It Gets Better Project, I was on television a lot talking about it, and I kept saying, you know, game over. You can't stop us anymore by accusing us of recruiting or being pedophiles. You can't, the culture has to stop pretending that there's no such thing as queer kids, because there are. We don't jump fully formed out of the backs of gay bars at age 21. Pride beads around our necks. So I kept saying on TV, game over, we're going to talk to your queer kids whether you want us to or not. Fuck you, basically, is what that translates into, right? And I would say, we're going to talk to your queer kids whether they're preachers, teachers, or parents like it or not. And she wrote, this kid, and it makes me so weepy, this kid wrote that not only were the videos giving her hope for her future, they were giving her hope for her parents. Because she was seeing people whose parents were her parents and came around. She was seeing parents like my parents who came around, right? And what she said at the end of her letter, which changed the way I talk about the It Gets Better Project on television, but not here among all of us, what she said in her letter was just so shattering. She said, every day I get up and I go downstairs and I look at my mother and my father and I love them for who they're going to be in 10 years. And she has that in her head. Not because Terry and I made 150,000 It Gets Better videos. We made one, but because so many other people made those videos and shared their stories and convinced her that that was possible even for her family. And one day, her parents are going to thank us for what we did for their daughter and for them. And she is the success story of the It Gets Better Project. That we reached that kid at that moment and gave her what she needed to get through it, but also gave her the insight that allows her to love her parents at a time when they are failing her and incapable of loving her. Thank you very much.